month in any one police station and so had to keep moving. All over the country, people were evicted from their homes. Many roamed the cities looking for food. Desperate workers tried to get to Europe or to South America. In 1878, the SS Metropolis, filled with laborers, left the United States for South America and sank with all aboard. The New York Tribune reported, 1 hour after the news that the ship had gone down arrived in Philadelphia, the office of Messrs. Collins was besieged by hundreds of hunger-bitten, decent men begging for the places of the drowned laborers. Mass meeting and demonstrations of the unemployed took place all over the country. Unemployed councils were set up. A meeting in New York at Cooper Institute in late 1873, organized by trade unions and the American section of the First International, founded in 1864 in Europe by Marx and others, drew a huge crowd overflowing into the streets. The meeting asked that before bills became law, they should be approved by a public vote, that no individual should own more than $30,000. They asked for an 8-hour day. Also, whereas we are industrious, law-abiding citizens who had paid all taxes and given support and allegiance to the government, resolved that we will in this time of need supply ourselves and our families with proper food and shelter, and we will send our bills to the city treasury to be liquidated until we shall obtain work. In Chicago, 20,000 unemployed marched through the streets to City Hall, asking, "Bread for the needy, clothing for the naked, and houses for the homeless." Actions like this resulted in some relief for about 10,000 families. In January 1874 in New York City, a huge parade of workers, kept by the police from approaching City Hall, went to Tompkins Square, and there were told by the police they couldn't have the meeting. They stayed and the police attacked. One newspaper reported, "Police clubs rose and fell. Women and children ran screaming in all directions. Many of them were trampled underfoot in the stampede for the gates. In the street, bystanders were ridden down and mercilessly clubbed by mounted officers." Strikes were called in the textile mills of Fall River, Massachusetts. In the anthracite coal district of Pennsylvania, there was the Long Strike, where Irish members of a society called the Ancient Order of Hibernians were accused of acts of violence, mostly on the testimony of a detective planted among the miners. These were the Molly Maguires. They were tried and found guilty. Philip Foner believes, after a study of the evidence, that they were framed because they were labor organizers. He quotes the sympathetic Irish World, which called them intelligent men whose direction gave strength to the resistance of the miners, to the inhuman reduction of their wages. And he points to the Miners' Journal, put out by the coal mine owners, which referred to the executed men this way. What did they do? Whenever prices of labor did not suit them, they organized and proclaimed a strike. Altogether, 19 were executed, according to Anthony Bimba, the Molly Maguires. There were scattered protests from working men's organizations, but no mass movement that could stop the executions. It was a time when employers brought in recent immigrants, desperate for work, different from the strikers in language and culture, to break strikes. Italians were imported into the bituminous coal area around Pittsburgh in 1874 to replace striking miners. This led to the killing of 3 Italians, to trials in which jurors of the community exonerated the strikers, and bitter feelings between Italians and other organized workers. The centennial year of 1876, 100 years after the Declaration of Independence, brought forth a number of new declarations, reproduced by Philip Foner in We the Other People. Whites and blacks, separately, expressed their disillusionment. A Negro Declaration of Independence denounced the Republican Party on which they had once depended to gain full freedom, and proposed independent political action by colored voters. And the Working Men's Party of Illinois, at a July 4th celebration organized by German socialists in Chicago, said in its Declaration of Independence, "The present system has enabled capitalists to make laws in their own interest to the injury and oppression of the workers. It has made the name democracy, for which our forefathers fought and died, a mockery and a shadow, by giving to property an unproportionate amount of representation and control over legislation. It has enabled capitalists to secure government aid, inland grants, and money loans to selfish railroad corporations, who by monopolizing the means of transportation are enabled to swindle both the producer and the consumer. It has presented to the world the absurd spectacle of a deadly civil war for the abolition of Negro slavery, while the majority of the white population, those who have created all the wealth of the nation, are compelled to suffer under a bondage infinitely more galling and humiliating. It has allowed the capitalists, as a class, to appropriate annually 5/6 of the entire production of the country. It has therefore prevented mankind from fulfilling their natural destinies on earth, crushed out ambition, prevented marriages, or caused false and unnatural ones, has shortened human life, destroyed morals, and fostered crime, corrupted judges, ministers, and statesmen, shattered confidence, love, and honor among men, and made life a selfish, merciless struggle for existence instead of a noble and generous struggle for perfection, in which equal advantages should be given to all and human lives relieved from an unnatural and degrading competition for bread. We, therefore, the representatives of the workers of Chicago, in mass meeting assembled, do solemnly publish and declare that we are absolved from all allegiance to the existing political parties of this country, and that as free and independent producers, we shall endeavor to acquire the full power to make our own laws, manage our own production, and govern ourselves, acknowledging no rights without duties, no duties without rights. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the assistance and cooperation of all working men, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our means, and our sacred honor." In the year 1877, the country was in the depths of the Depression. That summer, in the hot cities where poor families lived in cellars and drank infested water, the children became sick in large numbers. The New York Times wrote, "Already the cry of the dying children begins to be heard. Soon, to judge from the past, there will be 1,000 deaths of infants per week in the city." That first week in July in Baltimore, where all liquid sewage ran through the streets, 139 babies died. That year there came a series of tumultuous strikes by railroad workers in 12 cities. They shook the nation as no labor conflict in its history had done. It began with wage cuts on railroad after railroad, intense situations of already low wages, $1.75 a day for brakemen working 12 hours, scheming and profiteering by the railroad companies, deaths and injuries among the workers, loss of hands, feet, fingers, the crushing of men between cars. At the Baltimore and Ohio station in Martinsburg, West Virginia, workers determined to fight the wage cut went on strike, uncoupled the engines, ran them into the roundhouse, and announced no more trains would leave Martinsburg until the 10% cut was canceled. A crowd of support gathered, too many for the local police to disperse. B&O officials asked the governor for military protection, and he sent in militia. A train tried to get through, protected by the militia, and a striker trying to derail it exchanged gunfire with the militiaman attempting to stop him. The striker was shot in his thigh and his arm. His arm was amputated later that day, and 9 days later he died. 600 freight trains now jammed the yards at Martinsburg. The West Virginia governor applied to newly elected President Rutherford Hayes for federal troops, saying the state militia was insufficient. In fact, the militia was not totally reliable, being composed of many railroad workers. Much of the U.S. Army was tied up in Indian battles in the West. Congress had not appropriated money for the Army yet, but J.P. Morgan, August Belmont, and other bankers now offered to lend money to pay Army officers, but no enlisted men. Federal troops arrived in Martinsburg, and the freight cars began to move. In Baltimore, a crowd of thousands sympathetic to the railroad strikers surrounded the armory of the National Guard, which had been called out by the governor at the request of the B&O Railroad. The crowd hurled rocks, and the soldiers came out firing. The streets now became the scene of a moving, bloody battle. When the evening was over, 10 men or boys were dead, more badly wounded, one soldier wounded. Half of the 120 troops quit, and the rest went on to the train depot, where a crowd of 200 smashed the engine of a passenger train, tore up tracks, and engaged the militia again in a running battle. By now, 15,000 people surrounded the depot. Soon, three passenger cars, the station platform, and a locomotive were on fire. The governor asked for federal troops, and Hayes responded. 500 soldiers arrived, and Baltimore quieted down. The rebellion of the railroad workers now spread. Joseph Dacus, then editor of the St. Louis Republican, reported, "Strikes were occurring almost every hour. The great state of Pennsylvania was in an uproar. New Jersey was afflicted by a paralyzing dread. New York was mustering an army of militia. Ohio was shaken from Lake Erie to the Ohio River. Indiana rested in a dreadful suspense. Illinois, and especially its great metropolis, Chicago, apparently hung on the verge of a vortex of confusion and tumult. St. Louis had already felt the effect of the premonitory shocks of the uprising." The strike spread to Pittsburgh and the Pennsylvania Railroad. Again, it happened outside the regular union, pent-up anger exploding without plan. Robert Bruce, historian of the 1877 strikes, writes, 1877, year of violence, about a flagman named Gus Harris. Harris refused to go out on a double-header, a train with two locomotives carrying a double length of cars, to which railroaders had objected because it required fewer workers and made the brakeman's work more dangerous. The decision was his own, not part of a concerted plan or a general understanding. Had he lain awake that past night, listening to the rain, asking himself if he dared quit, wondering if anyone would join him, weighing the chances? Or had he simply risen to a breakfast that did not fill him, seen his children go off shabby and half-fed, walked brooding through the damp morning, and then yielded impulsively to stored-up rage? When Harris said he would not go, the rest of the crew refused too. The strikers now multiplied, joined by young boys and men from the mills and factories. Pittsburgh had 33 iron mills, 73 glass factories, 29 oil refineries, 158 coal mines. The freight trains stopped moving out of the city. The trainmen's union had not organized this, but it moved to take hold, calling a meeting, inviting all working men to make common cause with their brethren on the railroad. Railroad and local officials decided that the Pittsburgh militia would not kill their fellow townsmen and urged that Philadelphia troops be called in. By now, 2,000 cars were idle in Pittsburgh. The Philadelphia troops came and began to clear the track. Rocks flew. Gunfire was exchanged between crowd and troops. At least 10 people were killed, all working men, most of them not railroaders. Now the whole city rose in anger. A crowd surrounded the troops, who moved into a roundhouse. Railroad cars were set afire, buildings began to burn, and finally the roundhouse itself, the troops marching out of it to safety. There was more gunfire. The Union Depot was set afire. Thousands looted the freight cars. A huge grain elevator and a small section of the city went up in flames. In a few days, 24 people had been killed, including 4 soldiers. 79 buildings had been burned to the ground. Something like a general strike was developing in Pittsburgh. Mill workers, car workers, miners, laborers, and the employees at the Carnegie Steel Plant. The entire National Guard of Pennsylvania, 9,000 men, was called out. But many of the companies couldn't move as strikers in other towns held up traffic. In Lebanon, Pennsylvania, one National Guard company mutinied and marched through an excited town. In Altoona, troops surrounded by rioters, immobilized by sabotaged engines, surrendered, stacked arms, fraternized with the crowd, and then were allowed to go home to the accompaniment of singing by a quartet in an all-Negro militia company. In Harrisburg, the state capital, as at so many places, teenagers made up a large part of the crowd, which included some Negroes. Philadelphia militia, on their way home from Altoona, shook hands with the crowd, gave up their guns, marched like captives through the streets, were fed at a hotel, and then sent home. The crowd agreed to the mayor's request to deposit the surrendered guns at the city hall. Factories and shops were idle. After some looting, citizens' patrols kept order in the streets through the night. Where strikers did not manage to take control, as in Pottsville, Pennsylvania, it may well have been because of disunity. The spokesman of the Philadelphia and Reading Coal and Iron Company in that town wrote, "The men have no organization, and there is too much race jealousy existing among them to permit them to form one." In Reading, Pennsylvania, there was no such problem. 90% were native-born, the rest mostly German. There, the railroad was 2 months behind in paying wages, and a branch of the trainmen's union was organized. 2,000 people gathered, while men who had blackened their faces with coal dust set about methodically tearing up tracks, jamming switches, derailing cars, setting fire to cabooses, and also to a railroad bridge. A National Guard company arrived, fresh from duty at the execution of the Molly Maguires. The crowd threw stones, fired pistols. The soldiers fired into the crowd. 6 men lay dead in the twilight, Bruce reports. A fireman and an engineer formerly employed in the Reading, a carpenter, a huckster, a rolling mill worker, a laborer, a policeman, and another man lay at the point of death. 5 of the wounded died. The crowd grew angrier, more menacing. A contingent of soldiers announced it would not fire. One soldier saying he would rather put a bullet through the president of Philadelphia and Reading Coal and Iron. The 16th Regiment of the Morristown Volunteers stacked its arms. Some militia threw their guns away and gave their ammunition to the crowd. When the guardsmen left for home, federal troops arrived and took control, and local police began making arrests. Meanwhile, the leaders of the big railway brotherhoods, the Order of Railway Conductors, the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen, the Brotherhood of Engineers, disavowed the strike. There was talk in the press of communistic ideas widely entertained by the workmen employed in mines and factories and by the railroads. In fact, there was a very active working men's party in Chicago, with several thousand members, most of them immigrants from Germany and Bohemia. It was connected with the First International in Europe. In the midst of the railroad strikes that summer of 1877, it called a rally. 6,000 people came and demanded nationalization of the railroads. Albert Parsons gave a fiery speech. He was from Alabama, had fought in the Confederacy during the Civil War, married a brown-skinned woman of Spanish and Indian blood, worked as a typesetter, and was one of the best English-speaking orators the Working Men's Party had. The next day, a crowd of young people, not especially connected with the rally of the evening before, began moving through the railroad yards, closed down the freights, went to the factories, called out the mill workers, the stockyard workers, the crewmen on the Lake Michigan ships, closed down the brickyards and lumber yards. That day also, Albert Parsons was fired from his job with the Chicago Times and declared blacklisted. The police attacked the crowds. The press reported, The sound of clubs falling on skulls was sickening for the first minute until one grew accustomed to it. A rioter dropped at every whack, it seemed, for the ground was covered with them. Two companies of U.S. infantry arrived, joining National Guardsmen and Civil War veterans. Police fired into a surging crowd, and three men were killed. The next day, an armed crowd of 5,000 fought the police. The police fired again and again, and when it was over and the dead were counted, there were, as usual, working men and boys, 18 of them, their skulls smashed by clubs, their vital organs pierced by gunfire. The one city where the Working Men's Party clearly led the rebellion was St. Louis, a city of flour mills, foundries, packing houses, machine shops, breweries, and railroads. Here, as elsewhere, there were wage cuts on the railroads, and here there were perhaps 1,000 members of the Working Men's Party, many of them bakers, coopers, cabinet makers, cigar makers, brewery workers. The party was organized in 4 sections by nationality: German, English, French, Bohemian. All 4 sections took a ferry across the Mississippi to join a mass meeting of railroad men in East St. Louis. One of their speakers told the meeting, "All you have to do, gentlemen, for you have the numbers, is to unite on one idea, that the working men shall rule the country. What man makes belongs to him, and the working men made this country." Railroaders in East St. Louis declared themselves on strike. The mayor of East St. Louis was a European immigrant, himself an active revolutionist as a youth, and railroad men's votes dominated the city. In St. Louis itself, the Working Men's Party called an open-air mass meeting to which 5,000 people came. The party was clearly in the leadership of the strike. Speakers, excited by the crowd, became more militant. "Capital has changed liberty into serfdom, and we must fight or die." They called for nationalization of the railroads, mines, and all industry. At another huge meeting of the Working Men's Party, a black man spoke for those who worked on the steamboats and levees. He asked, "Will you stand to us regardless of color?" The crowd shouted back, "We will." An executive committee was set up, and it called for a general strike of all branches of industry in St. Louis. Handbills for the general strike were soon all over the city. There was a march of 400 Negro steamboat men and roustabouts along the river. 600 factory workers carrying a banner: "No monopoly, working men's rights." A great procession moved through the city, ending with a rally of 10,000 people listening to communist speakers. "The people are rising up in their might and declaring they will no longer submit to being oppressed by unproductive capital." David Burbank, in his book on the St. Louis events, Reign of the Rabble, writes, "Only around St. Louis did the original strike on the railroads expand into such a systematically organized and complete shutdown of all industry that the term general strike is fully justified. And only there did the socialists assume undisputed leadership. No American city has come so close to being ruled by a workers' Soviet, as we would now call it, as St. Louis, Missouri, in the year 1877. The railroad strikes were making news in Europe. Marx wrote Engels, "What do you think of the workers of the United States? This first explosion against the associated oligarchy of capital, which has occurred since the Civil War, will naturally again be suppressed, but can very well form the point of origin of an earnest workers' party." In New York, several thousand gathered at Tompkins Square. The tone of the meeting was moderate, speaking of a political revolution through the ballot box, and, "If you will unite, we may have here within 5 years a socialist republic. Then will a lovely morning break over this darkened land." It was a peaceful meeting. It adjourned. The last words heard from the platform were, "Whatever we poor men may not have, we have free speech, and no one can take it from us." Then the police charged, using their clubs. In St. Louis, as elsewhere, the momentum of the crowds, the meetings, the enthusiasm could not be sustained. As they diminished, the police, militia, and federal troops moved in, and the authorities took over. The police raided the headquarters of the Working Men's Party and arrested 70 people. The executive committee that had been for a while virtually in charge of the city was now in prison. The strikers surrendered. The wage cuts remained. 131 strike leaders were fired by the Burlington Railroad. When the great railroad strikes of 1877 were over, 100 people were dead. 1,000 people had gone to jail. 100,000 workers had gone on strike, and the strikes had roused into action countless unemployed in the cities. More than half the freight on the nation's 75,000 miles of track had stopped running at the height of the strikes. The railroads made some concessions, withdrew some wage cuts, but also strengthened their coal and iron police. In a large number of cities, National Guard armories were built with loopholes for guns. Robert Bruce believes the strikes taught many people of the hardships of others, and that they led to congressional railroad regulation. They may have stimulated the business unionism of the American Federation of Labor, as well as the national unity of labor proposed by the Knights of Labor and the independent labor-farmer parties of the next two decades. In 1877, the same year blacks learned they did not have enough strength to make real the promise of equality in the Civil War, working people learned they were not united enough, not powerful enough to defeat the combination of private capital and government power. But there was more to come. Chapter 11, Robber Barons and Rebels. In the year 1877, the signals were given for the rest of the century. The black would be put back. The strikes of white workers would not be tolerated. The industrial and political elites of North and South would take hold of the country and organize the greatest march of economic growth in human history. They would do it with the aid of and at the expense of black labor, white labor, Chinese labor, European immigrant labor, female labor, rewarding them differently by race, sex, national origin, and social class in such a way as to create separate levels of oppression, a skillful terracing to stabilize the pyramid of wealth. Between the Civil War and 1900, steam and electricity replaced human muscle, iron replaced wood, and steel replaced iron. Before the Bessemer process, iron was hardened into steel at the rate of 3 to 5 tons a day. Now the same amount could be processed in 15 minutes. Machines could now drive steel tools. Oil could lubricate machines and light homes, streets, factories. People and goods could move by railroad propelled by steam along steel rails. By 1900, there were 193,000 miles of railroad. The telephone, the typewriter, and the adding machine speeded up the work of business. Machines changed farming. Before the Civil War, it took 61 hours of labor to produce an acre of wheat. By 1900, it took 3 hours and 19 minutes. Manufactured ice enabled the transport of food over long distances, and the industry of meatpacking was born. Steam drove textile mill spindles. It drove sewing machines. It came from coal. Pneumatic drills now drilled deeper into the earth for coal. In 1860, 14 million tons of coal were mined. By 1884, it was 100 million tons. More coal meant more steel, because coal furnaces converted iron into steel. By 1880, 1 million tons of steel were being produced. By 1910, 25 million tons. By now, electricity was beginning to replace steam. Electrical wire needed copper, of which 30,000 tons were produced in 1880, 500,000 tons by 1910. To accomplish all this required ingenious inventors of new processes and new machines, clever organizers and administrators of the new corporations, a country rich with land and minerals, and a huge supply of human beings to do the backbreaking, unhealthful, and dangerous work. Immigrants would come from Europe and China to make the new labor force. Farmers, unable to buy the new machinery or pay the new railroad rates, would move to the cities. Between 1860 and 1914, New York grew from 850,000 to 4 million, Chicago from 110,000 to 2 million, Philadelphia from 650,000 to 1.5 million. In some cases, the inventor himself became the organizer of businesses, like Thomas Edison, inventor of electrical devices. In other cases, the businessman compiled other people's inventions, like Gustavus Swift, a Chicago butcher, who put together the ice-cooled railway car with the ice-cooled warehouse to make the first national meatpacking company in 1885. James Duke used a new cigarette rolling machine that could roll, paste, and cut tubes of tobacco into 100,000 cigarettes a day. In 1890, he combined the four biggest cigarette producers to form the American Tobacco Company. While some multimillionaires started in poverty, most did not. A study of the origins of 303 textile, railroad, and steel executives of the 1870s showed that 90% came from middle or upper-class families. The Horatio Alger stories of rags to riches were true for a few men, but mostly a myth, and a useful myth for control. Most of the fortune-building was done legally, with the collaboration of the government and the courts. Sometimes the collaboration had to be paid for. Thomas Edison promised New Jersey politicians $1,000 each in return for favorable legislation. Daniel Drew and Jay Gould spent $1 million to bribe the New York legislature to legalize their issue of $8 million in watered stock, stock not representing real value, on the Erie Railroad. The first transcontinental railroad was built with blood, sweat, politics, and thievery out of the meeting of the Union Pacific and Central Pacific Railroads. The Central Pacific started on the West Coast, going east. It spent $200,000 in Washington on bribes to get 9 million acres of free land and $24 million in bonds, and paid $79 million, an overpayment of $36 million, to a construction company which really was its own. The construction was done by 3,000 Irish and 10,000 Chinese over a period of 4 years, working for $1 or $2 a day. The Union Pacific started in Nebraska going west. It had been given 12 million acres of free land and $27 million in government bonds. It created the Credit Mobilier Company and gave them $94 million for construction when the actual cost was $44 million. Shares were being sold cheaply to congressmen to prevent investigation. This was at the suggestion of Massachusetts Congressman Oakes Ames, a shovel manufacturer and director of Credit Mobilier, who said, "There is no difficulty in getting men to look after their own property." The Union Pacific used 20,000 workers, war veterans and Irish immigrants, who laid 5 miles of track a day and died by the hundreds in the heat, the cold, and the battles with Indians opposing the invasion of their territory. Both railroads used longer, twisting routes to get subsidies from towns they went through. In 1869, amid music and speeches, the two crooked lines met in Utah. The wild fraud on the railroads led to more control of railroad finances by bankers who wanted more stability, profit by law rather than by theft. By the 1890s, most of the country's railway mileage was concentrated in six huge systems. Four of these were completely or partially controlled by the House of Morgan, and two others by the bankers Kuhn, Loeb, and Company. J.P. Morgan had started before the war as the son of a banker who began selling stocks for the railroads for good commissions. During the Civil War, he bought 5,000 rifles for $3.50 each from an army arsenal and sold them to a general in the field for $22 each. The rifles were defective and would shoot off the thumbs of the soldiers using them. A congressional committee noted this in the small print of an obscure report, but a federal judge upheld the deal as the fulfillment of a valid legal contract. Morgan had escaped military service in the Civil War by paying $300 to a substitute. So did John D. Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, Philip Armour, Jay Gould, and James Mellon. Mellon's father had written to him that a man may be a patriot without risking his own life or sacrificing his health. There are plenty of lives less valuable. It was the firm of Drexel Morgan and Company that was given a U.S. government contract to float a bond issue of $260 million. The government could have sold the bonds directly. It chose to pay the bankers $5 million in commission. On January 2, 1889, as Gustavus Myers reports, a circular marked private and confidential was issued by the three banking houses of Drexel Morgan and Company, Brown Brothers and Company, and Kidder Peabody and Company. The most painstaking care was exercised that this document should not find its way into the press or otherwise become public. Why this fear? Because the circular was an invitation to the great railroad magnates to assemble at Morgan's house, number 219 Madison Avenue, there to form, in the phrase of the day, an ironclad combination, a compact which would efface competition among certain railroads and unite those interests in an agreement by which the people of the United States would be bled even more effectively than before. There was a human cost to this exciting story of financial ingenuity. That year, 1889, records of the Interstate Commerce Commission showed that 22,000 railroad workers were killed or injured. In 1895, the gold reserve of the United States was depleted, while 26 New York City banks had $129 million in gold in their vaults. A syndicate of bankers headed by J.P. Morgan and Company, August Belmont and Company, the National City Bank, and others, offered to give the government gold in exchange for bonds. President Grover Cleveland agreed. The bankers immediately resold the bonds at higher prices, making $18 million profit. A journalist wrote, "If a man wants to buy beef, he must go to the butcher. If Mr. Cleveland wants much gold, he must go to the big banker." While making his fortune, Morgan brought rationality and organization to the national economy. He kept the system stable. He said, "We do not want financial convulsions and have one thing one day and another thing another day." He linked railroads to one another, all of them to banks, banks to insurance companies. By 1900, he controlled 100,000 miles of railroad, half the country's mileage. Three insurance companies dominated by the Morgan Group had $1 billion in assets. They had $50 million a year to invest, money given by ordinary people for their insurance policies. Louis Brandeis, describing this in his book, Other People's Money, before he became a Supreme Court justice, wrote, "They control the people through the people's own money." John D. Rockefeller started as a bookkeeper in Cleveland, became a merchant, accumulated money, and decided that in the new industry of oil, who controlled the oil refineries controlled the industry. He bought his first oil refinery in 1862, and by 1870 set up Standard Oil Company of Ohio, made secret agreements with railroads to ship his oil with them if they gave him rebates, discounts on their prices, and thus drove competitors out of business. One independent refiner said, "If we did not sell out, we would be crushed out. There was only one buyer on the market, and we had to sell at their terms." memos like this one passed among Standard Oil officials. Wilkerson and Company receive car of oil Monday 13th. Please turn another screw. A rival refinery in Buffalo was rocked by a small explosion arranged by Standard Oil officials with the refinery's chief mechanic. The Standard Oil Company, by 1899, was a holding company which controlled the stock of many other companies. The capital was $110 million. The profit was $45 million a year. And John D. Rockefeller's fortune was estimated at $200 million. Before long, he would move into iron, copper, coal, shipping, and banking, Chase Manhattan Bank. Profits would be $80 million a year, and the Rockefeller fortune would total $2 billion. Andrew Carnegie was a telegraph clerk at 17, then secretary to the head of the Pennsylvania Railroad, then broker in Wall Street, selling railroad bonds for huge commissions, and was soon a millionaire. He went to London in 1872, saw the new Bessemer method of producing steel, and returned to the United States to build a million-dollar steel plant. Foreign competition was kept out by a high tariff conveniently set by Congress, and by 1880, Carnegie was producing 10,000 tons of steel a month, making $1.5 million a year in profit. By 1900, he was making $40 million a year. And that year, at a dinner party, he agreed to sell his steel company to J.P. Morgan. He scribbled the price on a note, $492 million. Morgan then formed the U.S. Steel Corporation, combining Carnegie's corporation with others. He sold stocks and bonds for $1.3 billion, about $400 million more than the combined worth of the companies, and took a fee of $150 million for arranging the consolidation. How could dividends be paid to all those stockholders and bondholders? By making sure Congress passed tariffs, keeping out foreign steel, by closing off competition and maintaining the price at $28 a ton, and by working 200,000 men 12 hours a day for wages that barely kept their families alive. And so it went. In industry after industry, shrewd, efficient businessmen building empires, choking out competition, maintaining high prices, keeping wages low, using government subsidies. These industries were the first beneficiaries of the welfare state. By the turn of the century, American Telephone and Telegraph had a monopoly of the nation's telephone system. International Harvester made 85% of all farm machinery. And in every other industry, resources became concentrated, controlled. The banks had interests in so many of these monopolies as to create an interlocking network of powerful corporation directors, each of whom sat on the boards of many other corporations. According to a Senate report of the early 20th century, Morgan at his peak sat on the board of 48 corporations, Rockefeller, 37 corporations. Meanwhile, the government of the United States was behaving almost exactly as Karl Marx described a capitalist state, pretending neutrality to maintain order, but serving the interests of the rich. Not that the rich agreed among themselves. They had disputes over policies. But the purpose of the state was to settle upper-class disputes peacefully, control lower-class rebellion, and adopt policies that would further the long-range stability of the system. The arrangement between Democrats and Republicans to elect Rutherford Hayes in 1877 set the tone. Whether Democrats or Republicans won, national policy would not change in any important way. When Grover Cleveland, a Democrat, ran for president in 1884, the general impression in the country was that he opposed the power of monopolies and corporations, and that the Republican Party, whose candidate was James Blaine, stood for the wealthy. But when Cleveland defeated Blaine, Jay Gould wired him, "I feel that the vast business interests of the country will be entirely safe in your hands." And he was right. One of Cleveland's chief advisors was William Whitney, a millionaire and corporation lawyer who married into the Standard Oil fortune and was appointed Secretary of the Navy by Cleveland. He immediately set about to create a steel navy, buying the steel at artificially high prices from Carnegie's plants. Cleveland himself assured industrialists that his election should not frighten them. No harm shall come to any business interest as the result of administrative policy so long as I am president. A transfer of executive control from one party to another does not mean any serious disturbance of existing conditions. The presidential election itself had avoided real issues. There was no clear understanding of which interests would gain and which would lose if certain policies were adopted. It took the usual form of election campaigns, concealing the basic similarity of the parties by dwelling on personalities, gossip, trivialities. Henry Adams, an astute literary commentator on that era, wrote to a friend about the election. "We are here plunged in politics funnier than words can express. Very great issues are involved. But the amusing thing is that no one talks about real interests. By common consent, they agree to let these alone. We are afraid to discuss them. Instead of this, the press is engaged in a most amusing dispute whether Mr. Cleveland had an illegitimate child and did or did not live with more than one mistress." In 1887, with a huge surplus in the Treasury, Cleveland vetoed a bill appropriating $100,000 to give relief to Texas farmers to help them buy seed grain during a drought. He said, "Federal aid in such cases encourages the expectation of paternal care on the part of the government and weakens the sturdiness of our national character." But that same year, Cleveland used his gold surplus to pay off wealthy bondholders at $28 above the $100 value of each bond, a gift of $45 million. The chief reform of the Cleveland administration gives away the secret of reform legislation in America. The Interstate Commerce Act of 1887 was supposed to regulate the railroads on behalf of the consumers. But Richard Olney, a lawyer for the Boston and Maine and other railroads, and soon to be Cleveland's attorney general, told railroad officials who complained about the Interstate Commerce Commission that it would not be wise to abolish the commission from a railroad point of view. He explained, "The commission is or can be made of great use to the railroads. It satisfies the popular clamor for a government supervision of railroads, at the same time that that supervision is almost entirely nominal. The part of wisdom is not to destroy the commission, but to utilize it." Cleveland himself, in his 1887 State of the Union message, had made a similar point, adding a warning. "Opportunity for safe, careful, and deliberate reform is now offered, and none of us should be unmindful of a time when an abused and irritated people may insist upon a radical and sweeping rectification of their wrongs." Republican Benjamin Harrison, who succeeded Cleveland as president from 1889 to 1893, was described by Matthew Josephson in his colorful study of the post-Civil War years, The Politicos. Benjamin Harrison had the exclusive distinction of having served the railway corporations in the dual capacity of lawyer and soldier. He prosecuted the strikers of 1887 in the federal courts, and he also organized and commanded a company of soldiers during the strike. Harrison's term also saw a gesture toward reform. The Sherman Antitrust Act, passed in 1890, called itself an act to protect trade and commerce against unlawful restraints, and made it illegal to form a combination or conspiracy to restrain trade in interstate or foreign commerce. Senator John Sherman, author of the act, explained the need to conciliate the critics of monopoly. "They had monopolies of old, but never before such giants as in our day. You must heed their appeal or be ready for the socialist, the communist, the nihilist. Society is now disturbed by forces never felt before. When Cleveland was elected president again in 1892, Andrew Carnegie in Europe received a letter from the manager of his steel plants, Henry Clay Frick. "I am very sorry for President Harrison, but I cannot see that our interests are going to be affected one way or the other by the change in administration." Cleveland, facing the agitation in the country caused by the Panic and Depression of 1893, used troops to break up Coxey's Army, a demonstration of unemployed men who had come to Washington, and again to break up the national strike on the railroads the following year. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court, despite its look of somber, black-robed fairness, was doing its bit for the ruling elite. How could it be independent, with its members chosen by the president and ratified by the Senate? How could it be neutral between rich and poor, when its members were often former wealthy lawyers and almost always came from the upper class? Early in the 19th century, the court laid the legal basis for a nationally regulated economy by establishing federal control over interstate commerce and the legal basis for corporate capitalism by making the contract sacred. In 1895, the court interpreted the Sherman Act so as to make it harmless. It said a monopoly of sugar refining was a monopoly in manufacturing, not commerce, and so could not be regulated by Congress through the Sherman Act, U.S. v. E.C. Knight Company. The court also said the Sherman Act could be used against interstate strikes, the railway strike of 1894, because they were in restraint of trade. It also declared unconstitutional a small attempt by Congress to tax high incomes at a higher rate, Pollock v. Farmers Loan and Trust Company. In later years, it would refuse to break up the Standard Oil and American Tobacco monopolies, saying the Sherman Act barred only unreasonable combinations in restraint of trade. A New York banker toasted the Supreme Court in 1895. "I give you, gentlemen, the Supreme Court of the United States, guardian of the dollar, defender of private property, enemy of spoliation, sheet anchor of the Republic." Very soon after the 14th Amendment became law, the Supreme Court began to demolish it as a protection for blacks and to develop it as a protection for corporations. However, in 1877, a Supreme Court decision, Munn v. Illinois, approved state laws regulating the prices charged to farmers for the use of grain elevators. The grain elevator company argued it was a person being deprived of property, thus violating the 14th Amendment's declaration, "Nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law." The Supreme Court disagreed, saying that grain elevators were not simply private property, but were invested with a public interest, and so could be regulated. 1 year after that decision, the American Bar Association, organized by lawyers accustomed to serving the wealthy, began a national campaign of education to reverse the court decisions. Its president said, at different times, "If trusts are a defensive weapon of property interests against the communistic trend, they are desirable." And, "Monopoly is often a necessity and an advantage." By 1886, they succeeded. State legislatures, under the pressure of aroused farmers, had passed laws to regulate the rates charged farmers by the railroads. The Supreme Court that year, Wabash v. Illinois, said states could not do this, that this was an intrusion on federal power. That year alone, the court did away with 230 state laws that had been passed to regulate corporations. By this time, the Supreme Court had accepted the argument that corporations were persons and their money was property protected by the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. Supposedly, the amendment had been passed to protect Negro rights, but of the 14th Amendment cases brought before the Supreme Court between 1890 and 1910, 19 dealt with the Negro. 288 dealt with corporations. The justices of the Supreme Court were not simply interpreters of the Constitution. They were men of certain backgrounds, of certain interests. One of them, Justice Samuel Miller, had said in 1875, "It is vain to contend with judges who have been at the bar the advocates for 40 years of railroad companies and all forms of associated capital." In 1893, Supreme Court Justice David J. Brewer, addressing the New York State Bar Association, said, "It is the unvarying law that the wealth of the community will be in the hands of the few. The great majority of men are unwilling to endure that long self-denial and saving which makes accumulations possible. And hence it has always been, and until human nature is remodeled, always will be true, that the wealth of a nation is in the hands of a few, while the many subsist upon the proceeds of their daily toil." This was not just a whim of the 1880s and 1890s. It went back to the founding fathers, who had learned their law in the era of Blackstone's commentaries, which said, "So great is the regard of the law for private property that it will not authorize the least violation of it, no, not even for the common good of the whole community." Control in modern times requires more than force, more than law. It requires that a population dangerously concentrated in cities and factories, whose lives are filled with cause for rebellion, be taught that all is right as it is. And so, the schools, the churches, the popular literature taught that to be rich was a sign of superiority, to be poor a sign of personal failure, and that the only way upward for a poor person was to climb into the ranks of the rich by extraordinary effort and extraordinary luck. In those years after the Civil War, a man named Russell Conwell, a graduate of Yale Law School, a minister and author of best-selling books, gave the same lecture, Acres of Diamonds, more than 5,000 times to audiences across the country, reaching several million people in all. His message was that anyone could get rich if he tried hard enough, that everywhere, if people looked closely enough, were acres of diamonds, a sampling. "I say you ought to get rich, and it is your duty to get rich. The men who get rich may be the most honest men you find in the community. Let me say here clearly, 98 out of 100 of the rich men of America are honest. That is why they are rich. That is why they are trusted with money. That is why they carry on great enterprises and find plenty of people to work with them. It is because they are honest men. I sympathize with the poor, but the number of poor who are to be sympathized with is very small. To sympathize with a man whom God has punished for his sins is to do wrong. Let us remember there is not a poor person in the United States who was not made poor by his own shortcomings." Conwell was a founder of Temple University. Rockefeller was a donor to colleges all over the country and helped found the University of Chicago. Huntington of the Central Pacific gave money to two Negro colleges, Hampton Institute and Tuskegee Institute. Carnegie gave money to colleges and to libraries. Johns Hopkins was founded by a millionaire merchant and millionaires Cornelius Vanderbilt, Ezra Cornell, James Duke, and Leland Stanford created universities in their own names. The rich, giving part of their enormous earnings in this way, became known as philanthropists. These educational institutions did not encourage dissent. They trained the middlemen in the American system, the teachers, doctors, lawyers, administrators, engineers, technicians, politicians, those who would be paid to keep the system going, to be loyal buffers against trouble. In the meantime, the spread of public school education enabled the learning of writing, reading, and arithmetic, for a whole generation of workers, skilled and semi-skilled, who would be the literate labor force of the new industrial age. It was important that these people learn obedience to authority. A journalist observer of the schools in the 1890s wrote, "The unkindly spirit of the teacher is strikingly apparent. The pupils, being completely subjugated to her will, are